throw me smack down in the middle. Throw me smack down in the middle. Let me play smack down in the middle. I wanna be smack down. Hello and welcome to the Ragin' Moderate podcast, where we try to fact check everybody, regardless of the little R or D after their name. In today's episode, we'll take an inventory of the precarious centrist movement in the USA, including some of the very few moderates remaining in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. And we'll hear from some real-life centrist politicians who took on the system and who have the bruises to prove it. Thanks so much to our intelligent, discerning, and probably good-looking loyal listeners scattered throughout the USA. And welcome to any newbies who have just come along for the ride today. Hope you enjoy our little Ragin' Moderate cult we've got going on here. All right, let's do this. Last month, political junkies everywhere were looking for something to do, and so they focused on a nail-biter of a mayoral race in Omaha, Nebraska. Omaha, you've been weighing heavy on my mind. For a moment, it looked like a Democrat by the name of Heath Mello was within striking distance of a victory over the Republican incumbent. Battle-worn liberals nationwide were throwing money and publicity at the race. Even Bernie Sanders, currently the nation's most popular politician, hopped on a jet to stump for Mr. Mello.
That ability and capability of creating a 50-state party starts here tonight in Omaha, Nebraska.
But there was one problem. Although Mello vowed to fight for affordable housing, women's wage equality, and environmental regulations, he also admitted that he was having an extramarital affair with a bison. No, just kidding. Mello actually admitted that he was pro-life. But he probably should have just stuck with the buffalo mistress, because true blue Democrats were aghast that a so-called Democrat would restrict a woman's right to an abortion. And if that didn't anger the base enough, Bernie supported the guy. The new head of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, weighed in. After initially endorsing Mello, Perez then reversed course and put out a statement that read,
"Every Democrat, like every American, should support a woman's right to make her own choices about her body and her health. That is not negotiable and should not change city by city or state by state."
All the hubbub put a damper on the excitement of Mello's mayoral campaign. Left-leaning newspapers retracted their endorsements, the huge influx of campaign cash withered away, and Mello lost the election a few weeks later. Bernie Sanders licked his wounds, and the Republican Party used this schism to appeal to pro-life voters who realized they had no home in the Democratic Party.
In other words, partisan politics with no middle ground, just as nature intended.
This anecdote clearly raises the question, should the Democratic Party be non-negotiable on abortion, or on campaign finance reform, or on support for the Iraq War? Basically, is there room in the Democratic Party for anyone who strays from the party line? Now, it's not the same for the Republican Party. To their credit, the GOP's big tent allows for much more diversity of views. You've got the social conservatives who care about God and guns, not necessarily in that order. You've got the fiscal hawks and libertarians who want a good government that governs least. And you've got big business establishment Republicans who were in charge of the party until they were blindsided by whoever these Trump folks are.
Dear God, what is that thing?
Any one of those factions was too small to be a majority party, but the GOP somehow wraps them all up into a really, really powerful political force. The Democrats, on the other hand, are maybe ethnically diverse, but almost entirely monolithic. And this isn't just my astute analysis. Real deal science shows us that Democratic politicians are more ideologically homogenous than at any time in the last 100 years, while the Republican Party has grown more conservative and yet more ideologically diverse in recent decades. Now, it must be said that when it comes to recent presidential nominees, the Democratic Party has actually trended toward the center, nominating business-friendly so-called new Democrats like Bill and Hillary Clinton. Even Barack Obama, once a card-carrying liberal senator, irked his party's left-leaning wing with his compromising tenure as president.
The truth of the matter is that my policies are so mainstream that, you know, if I had said the same policies that I have back in the 1980s, I'd be considered a moderate Republican.
The Dems' increasingly liberal base often bemoans this trend of new Democrats as party flag bearers. But you can't argue with the results. Since 1992, the popular vote winner of all but one presidential election has been a Democrat.
Oh, he's right.
So if deep down, the average American seems to have a preference for centrist leaders, we sure have a funny way of showing it. Gallup surveys indicate that in the last two decades, Americans are much less likely to actually self-identify as a moderate.
Uh-oh!
Today, fully two-thirds of Americans have sworn an alliance to one side or the other.
The time for war has come. Choose your side. Join the battle.
So, we moderates are down, but certainly not out. We're still 34% of the country, which means approximately one out of every three people you encounter hasn't yet swallowed the hyper-partisan pill. And the number of self-identified independents has doubled since the 60s.
There's still hope.
But only if that were true of our elected officials. The Brookings Institute has ranked every member of Congress on a 0 to 10 conservative to liberal ideological scale. A congressperson scoring 5 on the scale would be a pure centrist. A 10 would be a radical Che Guevara statist liberal. A 0 would be a hyper-conservative Ayn Rand Ted Cruz love child. From 1950 through 1980, the average Republican senator hovered around a 3 on that scale. That number has since dropped down to a 1. Democrats, of course, have gone the opposite direction, just not as far. They've moved from about a 7 up to an 8.5.
You've changed. I don't know you anymore. You're going down a path I can't follow.
In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, even though there was some turbulent stuff occurring in the USA, statistical analysis shows that members of Congress were far more likely to reach across the aisle to pass legislation. There were literally tens of thousands of such cross-party pairs during these years. History nerds will note that part of the reason for the lack of rigid party lines was that Southern Democrats were splitting off during the Civil Rights Movement. But don't overstate that impact. Even the Voting Rights Act of 1965, a monumental moment in the Civil Rights Movement, passed the House with 328 yeas to just 74 nays. In the Senate, 79 voted for the Voting Rights Act, just 19 against it. That's like remarkably bipartisan. Similarly, key Cold War legislation like the Marshall Plan and the War Powers Act were crafted in a way that guaranteed they'd sail through Congress. Compare that to the present day where Congress can barely pass a farm bill, much less a budget. In a grand display of pointless showmanship, there are currently more bills being introduced than ever, and yet a historically small percentage are actually being signed into law.
There's clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Stuck in the middle with you. Stuck in the middle with you. Stuck in the middle with you.
The writer Steven Seibert has an interesting working definition for the term moderate. He calls it someone who is open to listening to the truths of others. Kind of sanctimonious, but I like it. It implies that facts and pragmatism should always trump ideology. But I totally realize that's not everyone's jam, especially in today's noxious political climate. That's not to say there aren't a few moderate or centrist or independent politicians out there. They're just having a hell of a time being purple in a political world of deep red and blue.
It's
So I decided to run as an independent for U.S. House in 2014 in the aftermath of the government shutdown.
That's Nick Troiano, a young centrist from Pennsylvania. Disgusted with the partisan gridlock, Troiano decided to run for Congress in 2014 at the ripe old age of 24. His campaign platform was like a greatest hits of both the left and the right. Fiscal responsibility, economic opportunity, campaign finance reform, and environmental protection. Troiano spoke to the Raging Moderate podcast about the difficulties he and other independent-minded folks face when they run for political office, starting with the fact that Pennsylvania's 10th district was drawn in a contorted horseshoe shape that all but ensured that the district was safely deep red Republican territory. We already bemoaned this on episode 2 of this podcast, but the key malfunction of our primary system is that it all but guarantees that the most extreme candidates have a leg up on the more moderate ones.
The incumbent, he has absolutely no incentive to want to work across the aisle to get things done, because it just isn't what's popular among the small number of voters who vote in primary elections.
There are plenty of behind-the-scenes obstacles, too. While Troiano's independent candidacy could raise a max of $2,700 from any one donor, the political parties themselves were free to rake in much more cash. And if that wasn't enough, Troiano's incumbent opponent raised $500,000 from special interest groups while in office. That amount alone trumped Troiano's tiny campaign war chest.
We raised close to $170,000 by me making cold calls for a few hours a day. So it's hard to compete against the interests that are in Washington that support the political establishment on both sides.
To add insult to injury, independent candidates don't benefit from the well-oiled machinery of the two big parties.
How do you find a campaign team? How do you identify who your volunteers and supporters are if an independent hasn't run in the district before? How do you have access to the tools and technology that major party candidates use to get out the vote? Those are all implicit obstacles to independence that make it much tougher to run for office as well.
And lastly, there are psychological barriers to break through. Even though a plurality of voters identify as independent and a majority of voters have had it up to here with both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, that doesn't mean voters are willing to line up behind an independent candidate.
Voters haven't been very willing to actually throw their votes behind independents when they run, because there's some inherent skepticism that, a third party or independent candidate is maybe a bit kooky or on the extremes, or that worse, supporting them may either be wasting your vote or spoiling the election for the candidate that you most want to win.
In conclusion, the two-party duopoly in the U.S. makes it really hard for independent candidates. Despite getting national press and having the strongest showing of any independent in a three-way race, Troiano lost the election, earning just 13% of the vote in Pennsylvania's 10th district. But don't worry, we'll get back to Mr. Troiano later in this episode.
When I ran 2 years ago as a Republican, I was this reformed Republican trying to change the way that the Kansas Republican Party was moving. You can easily see that the Kansas GOP is on a fast track to self-destruction.
That's Alan LaPolice. In 2014, he ran as a Republican and challenged the ultra-conservative Tea Party incumbent in Kansas's 1st District. Like Nick Troiano, LaPolice ran into many of the same roadblocks, including getting out fundraised 30-1. But unlike Troiano, LaPolice came really close to actually pulling it off and unseating a politically extreme incumbent.
Our outgoing congressman is Tim Hillscamp, and Tim Hillscamp made a name for himself as being extremely divisive, an obstructionist. He's now the Tea Party chair, and he made a lot of enemies up on the Hill because of his style, his combativeness, particularly his abrasiveness towards Speaker Boehner.
After hobnobbing with some of the Republican establishment, LaPolice seemed poised to gain their support. And the S in support has a little dollar sign. But LaPolice soon found out that there were some strings attached.
they were willing to back me. I mean, a lot of people were willing to back me, but I quickly figured out that to get that backing, to get that support, they demanded absolute loyalty. You know, I was asked, will you vote for this person to be Speaker of the House? To which I responded, no. I was asked if I would follow a script along with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And to that, I said definitively no. I was never going to sell my loyalty to any kind of elite political hack, to any kind of establishment thug, because that's the easiest way to get in there. I wouldn't do it.
You see where this is going. La Police didn't get the backing of the GOP establishment, the Chamber of Commerce, and many other powerful political groups. And yet, he still managed to gain 45% of the vote, narrowly losing the Republican primary in Kansas's 1st District.
Yeah, I was a little bitter, and I had to make that concession call. And it was difficult to do because I knew that he wasn't going to be anything better than everything that's wrong with politics. I knew that he was going to be exactly more of the same. And I felt bitter.
Clear-eyed by the whole ordeal, Alan La Police gave it another go in 2016, but instead running as an independent. But this time, he secured just 26% of the vote. But that Tea Party incumbent, he also lost in 2016, this time to a heavily funded, establishment-backed Republican who currently has a 100% conservative voting record.
It's hard, and you're up against insurmountable odds. But if you believe in it, if you believe that this country is better than this and that the people of this country deserve better than this, and if you want to see future generations inherit a better system than what we've gotten, then work and fight and inspire people around you to get on board and back you, because you're in for one hell of a fight.
So if we're going to look for some trends so far, here's what I'm noticing. Independent or third-party candidates, phew, that's an uphill battle. But running within the two-party system, i.e. entering the primaries as a more centrist Republican or Democrat, that's still crazy difficult, especially if you're not willing to toe the line. But what about if you're one of the very few centrists who actually get elected? Then what? That leads us to Washington, D.C.'s most famous moderate, the Honorable Susan Collins of Maine.
Hello, Susie. Hello, Susie. Come in the room and enjoy yourself.
Senator Collins, thanks so much for being on the Raging Moderate podcast.
Thank you. It's great to join you.
Okay, I'm kidding. I'm not actually interviewing Susan Collins. She doesn't even know I exist. But no matter, because she's a rock star and she's important to our story today. Senator Collins gets accused by hardliners of being a rhino, Republican in name only. But she says she's a proud Republican, you know, when she's talking to other people, which is probably why she doesn't return my phone calls.
I believe in the traditional Republican values of personal responsibility, individual freedom, free markets, a strong national defense, keeping government out of certain aspects of our lives, although that's an area where the party has moved in a direction that I disagree with, and a belief that government is best when it's close to the people. And those core Republican values are what attracted me to the party in the first place.
And apparently her constituents are on Collins' side. She's ridiculously popular in Maine. In fact, she's got a 79% approval rating, making her the second most popular office holder in the country. Collins is admirably pragmatic and unpredictable. There literally isn't a single issue, not military spending or free trade or education or reproductive rights, in which Collins toes any party line. At the same time, Collins is totally old school when it comes to the integrity of the U.S. political system.
Good!
She has never missed a vote in the Senate, even when she broke her ankle.
Better!
She rightly pointed out that it was ridiculous for the GOP to stonewall Obama's Supreme Court nominee for over a year, arguing that the Supreme Court needs to be depoliticized.
Yes!
And all this makes Collins the ultimate swing vote. Earlier this year, she voted against the confirmation of Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education, leading to a 50-50 tally that was only broken by a very rare vice presidential tie-breaking vote. But Collins really started to punch above her weight during the most recent healthcare debate. First, a little background. When the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, was first rolled out in 2013, Collins voted no. But it wasn't like an immediate knee-jerk,
No.
It was more like,
I'm sorry, you're just not good enough.
Obama had been begging for Collins' support on the Affordable Care Act, and so Collins gave the Obama administration a list of healthcare must-haves. But when they didn't deliver, she withheld her support for the bill. Obamacare narrowly passed anyway, of course, but then the system started to crash and burn.
And if you want to know more about that, check out the Raging Moderate podcast about Obamacare.
So Susan Collins and Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana crafted a moderate bill that would have essentially allowed states to decide whether to keep Obamacare or replace it as long as the replacement covered all the same folks as Obamacare does. As you can imagine, this bill went nowhere. This spring, GOP leaders unveiled the American Health Care Act, the AHCA.
This bill, the American Health Care Act, it keeps our promise to repeal and replace Obamacare.
But Senator Susan Collins was having none of it. In a refreshing show of swagger, she and other moderate Republicans led a chorus of vocal opposition to the bill. At press time, centrists in the Senate seem to be stonewalling the AHCA until it undergoes some major changes to ensure that millions don't lose coverage. You see, Collins gets it. Moderates and centrists do have incredible influence in a tightly divided Congress if they know how to wield it and if their constituents are willing to put country over party, or at least problem-solving over purity.
Ability. Folks thought they would go far, but political incompatibility led to their downfall.
Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right. The one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear was a Methodist.
If you're like me, you're probably feeling a little disenchanted by the whole situation. Bringing in pragmatic, consensus-finding centrists is an uphill battle, to be sure. And most days, it seems like the problem is getting worse. But fear not, because turns out there's some awesome stuff happening below the radar. Remember Nick Troiano, the young Pennsylvania centrist who ran a doomed independent campaign for Congress? Well, instead of just entering the private sector and making boatloads of money and being happy for the rest of his life, Troiano is masochistically staying involved in politics and trying to change it at the grassroots level. He's joined up with something called the Centrist Project.
The Centrist Project has designed a clever hack to the two-party system to give government back to the people.
The Centrist Project is careful not to call itself a traditional third party, but rather an un-party. There's no party platform, and it doesn't even ask folks to change their party affiliation. But it is looking for independent-minded candidates who are sick of the status quo.
You know, this isn't about serving your party or narrow interest groups. It's about serving what's in the best interest of the country.
To that end, they've developed something called the Fulcrum Strategy.
The Fulcrum Strategy.
Essentially, the Centrist Project is trying to elect a coalition of 3 to 5 centrist senators to act as a block of swing votes. Adding just a handful of independent moderates would deny either party an outright majority and guarantee that the centrist voting bloc would have major clout. The Centrist Project is currently working on state legislatures too. They've identified Arizona, Colorado, Maine, Oregon, Nevada, and Connecticut as states with closely divided legislatures that are ripe and ready to elect independents. And the Centrist Project has recruited some heavy hitters with lots of political experience to help them battle against the institutional roadblocks that we spoke about earlier. Troiano and the other folks at the Centrist Project know that even with a top-notch strategy, this is going to be an uphill battle.
we have a rigged system politically. You know, both parties are serving themselves. They've rigged the rules. And we need to work together as Americans across the political spectrum and hopefully, you know, provide greater representation to people who feel like they don't have a voice.
In summary, as our country continues down the destructive path of hyperpartisanship, moderate politicians will find themselves in an increasingly strange situation. They're going to have a heck of a time winning elections and pleasing their more hardcore constituents. But at the same time, the few moderates who do make it will be disproportionately powerful swing votes in an era when most politicians are just rubber stamps for the party leaders. We Americans of the centrist persuasion can bemoan our political climate all we want, but we also have to take some ownership of the problem. That means being the voice of reason in our day-to-day conversations. It means calling out our own side when we've skidded off the rails, and it also means putting our money where our mouths are. In the upcoming 2018 elections, there are centrist Democrats in Arizona, Indiana, West Virginia, and North Dakota. And centrist Republicans in Maine, Nebraska, and Florida who are hanging on by a thread and could use all the help they can get right now. At the same time, the Centrist Project will very soon start rolling out their first round of independent candidates who have a serious chance of upending the status quo. Check their progress at centristproject.org. Thanks so much to Nick Troiano and Alan LaPolice for agreeing to appear on this episode, and thanks to Susan Collins for being my unrequited political crush. And of course, thank you, our faithful listeners who tune in each episode and who occasionally write me thoughtful emails and reading recommendations. I seriously love that. If you like this podcast and think it's important, share it. See you next week on The Rage and Moderate when we take on what might be considered part two of this episode, redistricting and gerrymandering. See you then.